Growing up, we all had assigned places at our table, all six of us. My mom and dad were at opposite ends of the table. My sister and I were on either side of my mom, and my two brothers were on either side of my dad. Meals always began with grace. But my father was the enforcer of manners, which were to be taught to us in our childhood as we sat at table. And there was a certain advantage from being a certain distance from him, because each infringement of manners at the table seemed to get a fork with the backside of it slapping your knuckles. That minute you thought no one was watching you put the peas on the fork was the exact moment that he noticed. So I rather liked my more distant position from Dad. Just the same, by the time we became young people, we had very good table etiquette and often got complimented on it, and no one knew the war scenes that preceded it that gave us those manners. But my favorite table belonged to my grandmother's. These were also tables where everything was preceded by grace. The food was always ample and very southern and very good. Usually there were 3 to 6 vegetables. There was always rice and gravy, and of course you had to have some kind of meat in order to create the gravy. We could sit in a new configuration when we visited in their homes. The kind of table was sort of open, except that you knew to sit neither at the head nor at the foot of the table, because those belonged to my grandparents. If I had my preference, I would always be next to one of my granddads. And I knew better than to challenge any other place there. The adults in this room also had certain ways of behaving. My grandparents, my grandmothers, would always have an adult to her right, and my grandfather would always have a child to his right, and thus the places of honor were divided between adults and children. And we had good enough manners so that my father's fork was only used to convey food into his mouth. Tables are not just about eating. They define hierarchy. They create a social community, provide us time to converse and catch up on our lives, share what we know. The very act of eating is filled with care. Someone has worked and bought the food, or in the cases of my grandfathers, they had gone to the garden and harvested the food, and we were now enjoying it. It was considerable thought was given to the way the table was laid out, and the food that was put on it and prepared and shared. And before you were allowed to be excused, there was one final piece of etiquette. You were to turn to whoever had made the meal and say, "Thank you, Mom, thank you, Grandmom, for making my dinner. May I now be excused?" If you forgot to say the thank you when you said, "May I now be excused," the whole room was in silence until you remembered to give the thank you. On top of that, guests were often very welcome at these tables. Jesus seems to feel the same way about tables. He is so often a guest at someone's table. Like today, being the Sabbath in the story, he shares a meal in the home of a Pharisee. He's being watched closely, we are told, as if his manners were not good enough, but it's probably his theology that was not good enough. Our reading skips over the first incident at this table. When he makes his first possible offense, there's a man who shows up with dropsy. If you don't know what dropsy is, it's the swelling of the limbs with water that comes because the heart is not pumping in its full extent, not able to do its job. Jesus, having good manners, asks the host, "Is it legal to heal on the Sabbath?" There is silence. Jesus takes that as assent and then makes note of it by saying, "If you can pull an ox out of a ditch on the Sabbath, well, why not heal?" And so he does. Then Jesus gets a little bit meddlesome. He takes note of where people are seating themselves. And I guess there were no place cards, so it was not brilliantly defined. Clearly, there are some who are going to the more honored positions. Perhaps this is a frequent gathering of people, and they know the pecking order, and they're sitting themselves in the pecking order. Just the same, Jesus begins to teach that it is far better to take the lower seat and then to be invited into the more prestigious one than it is to have to step down a notch from where you're seated. Now, if you don't have a picture of that, I can share that with you. In my last parish, there were a number of Nigerians and Ghanaians. And at wedding banquets or at special celebrations, there always was a high table where chiefs or more elevated members of the community or of the occasion would be seated. As a priest, I was often invited to come and say grace or to give some kind of introduction in the way of prayer to the occasion. And so I would always be seated at the high table. But I never presumed to go there. Following Jesus' advice, I would always sit down near the door, which is maybe the most treasured position because you can get out quickly, but nonetheless was considered lower. And I would wait, as everyone did, to be invited to sit higher. It was all very carefully choreographed. And one by one, the MC of the occasion would invite people forward in order of their importance. Only once in 15 years was I ever seated too high. Then it was that a chief and his wife arrived late for the dinner. And I was humbly asked, very quietly, could you move down two seats? Which I did. And the chief and his wife were seated. To be honest, I never understood the hierarchy. But I understood the embarrassment to the MC and the host when I had to be moved. And Jesus, quite frankly, in the gospel, is not really concerned with the etiquette of seating order. He's concerned with whether we lose our self-struggle to be self-important. The sign of letting go our self-importance is this willingness to take the lower place. What might that look like? Well, let's say we go to a UNC Chapel Hill or a Duke or a State University athletic event. There are those people who sit in the plush seats with the arms. And then there are those people who are sitting up in the nosebleed area where they can barely see. It might look something like the people in the plush seats just getting up and moving to the nosebleed, and the nosebleeds passing them down to sit where they sat. It's not very likely you'll ever see that, but that's what Jesus is mentioning. I don't know what your memory is, but I remember when President Jimmy Carter began to build Habitat for Humanity housing and speak publicly to it, we understood the significance of what he was doing, far more than when his mother decided to go off to the Peace Corps and nobody could stop talking about how that was inappropriate for the president's mother to do. But when he took up Habitat, we saw a person who was at the pinnacle of American political power take up a hammer and a saw and draw our attention to those who can be aided in gaining housing if we give of our talents and our gifts and our time. He raised a question. If a former president is so humble, can't we all be? And the remarkable thing about Habitat is you're not building housing for some family. You're building housing with a family. If ever you've been on a Habitat worksite, you meet the family, and they work right along with you as much as they can, given their own work life. You become peers in this action of building homes. Or when your children and the adult advisors go on a youth mission trip to Appalachia to repair houses for the desperately poor. They learn, we learn, what it is to take a seat further down the line. those trips are only in part about building and repairing housing for the poor and the elderly of the Appalachian region. They are equally about building awareness and making a difference. The stories that we hear on their return are always about what they've learned about the lives of the poor, what they've seen about their own lives as blessed. And sometimes they've actually gotten to know someone there and learn the vital stories of their life. And their life is blessed by it all. These are the vital lessons of Jesus. Humility as Jesus sees it, as the Christian faith understands it, is the practice of seeing others in their need and responding. And it's more than responding. It's becoming one with them in the place of their need. Thus it is that Jesus takes the supper party a step further. He essentially says, I know the custom. You invite family. You invite friends to your table. You invite those with social influence and power. You hope to maintain something or gain something. You know the rule. You write the thank you note at the end of the dinner, and you expect that they will now invite you back to their house. At least that's the way I was raised up. You were supposed to do. But God's reign is like this. Invite the poor, the crippled, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. And you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. We don't do that much, do we? It can be frightening and socially awkward to invite people we don't know or whose social station is very different than ours. And yet, we do remember the poor. And when we do, when we contribute to the food bank, when we help out in a soup kitchen, when we aid in a woman's shelter, when we buy holiday gifts for those in need, when we help build housing with Habitat for Humanity, we're on the right track. We're opening ourselves to others. We're focusing on another's need. And we're responding in tangible ways that ripple out into the fabric of community. And that was what was so wrong in Raleigh this week past, when a decision was made to enforce an ordinance long overlooked that required a permit to feed the hungry in a city park. A permit that cost between $300 and $800 per occasion. Love Wins Ministries has been feeding the homeless and the hungry for years in Moore Square without that ordinance being enforced. They do more than feed. They listen to people's lives. They're able to help some people move along to some form of self-sufficiency. But they also accept that there are some people in our society who are very fragile, and the culture does not serve them, and they are deserving of God's care. Their purpose is not to change people, but to be with them, to care for them, and care with them in the ways that seem best to them. They have stepped in where society has been stepping out for decades now. Perhaps the issue is the desire to further gentrify a neighborhood that was once divided black and white. That part of Raleigh was the area of the black business district in the segregated period. And it's an area that's been left to a certain neglect, but now gentrification is moving there. There are ways to do this that will also care for the poor, but they come at a cost. It would be the providing of space for their care, services that would care for them, and a kind of humility to acknowledge that people that are less fortunate are simply less fortunate. It cost us to recognize the poor as the special concern of God. Why? because it always has been in Scripture, the place where God puts a special notice. Perhaps because they are in the ditch now, and those of us who stand outside the ditch can lend a hand. They need our help often, but they can only receive it as they can receive it. It will come at a cost, and it will be deep, because we will learn about their lives, their barriers, their value, and their values. We heard of it in the reading from Hebrews, when the author writes, let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that, some have entertained angels without knowing it. If you don't know the allusion, it's the allusion to Abraham and Sarah, who entertained three strangers who arrived at their tent. Abraham and Sarah were just obeying the nomadic rule and custom of hospitality. A weary stranger was always given a meal, like some of our great-grandmothers always gave a biscuit when someone came to the back door hungry. They instead found in this encounter not just their own hospitality, but an encounter with God, and God's plan for their life was revealed. The biblical norm is that God leans on our lives most notably when we welcome the stranger, when we care for the poor, when we notice who is vulnerable and stop and aid them. Something in us opens, and if we listen, we will notice that there is something of God's care that is passing through us back into life, and it feels like compassion. Love does win to some degree. You may only see its reward at the resurrection of the righteous, but you may also find it deep within your own being, where God waits to be found and to urge you on to be his hands and feet and life in this world.